It's recall primary election day in Wisconsin today, but there will be no campaigning on this show this hour. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May 8th. We will be welcoming in Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, in just a moment, and he will answer your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It could be that this hour will be preempted tonight in its rebroadcast spot because there is going to be an election night special. The Wisconsin Public Radio election night recall primary special starts at 8 o'clock. You can get the election results and analysis from Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg. That's an election night special on the Ideas Network starting at 8 o'clock tonight. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
So, it is primary election day. We may or may not be heard tonight, depending on how fast the election results come in. And over the next few weeks and months, we're not going to campaign here, but certainly jobs will be on the minds of a lot of state and national voters. There's some question, though, Kevin, you say, as to how much blame or credit politicians should get for unemployment or employment figures.
No, yeah, but first of all, let's go back to this. You skipped over this. I'm a little concerned about the decline in our state and our country when the interest of the political outcome in the elections would supersede a repeat of this show.
I know. What's the world coming to?
What are we coming to, indeed? I'm really disappointed in that. Yes, Joy, it is the top concern cited by voters, according to the Pew Research Center. The top two concerns of voters that, when asked what was very important to them in the coming elections, 86% said the economy and 84% said jobs. And that's understandable. The current stated unemployment rate in the country is about 8.1%. In Wisconsin, the most recent figures are 7.9% unemployment. That is a little lower than in recent months, but it's higher than historically what the numbers have shown to be. So it's understandable that people would be focusing on this. And to be fair, the politicians generally have brought this upon themselves by trying to measure their performance in the number of people who are working. But it's still incorrect to judge a politician based on solely on the number of jobs that are created or not created.
So why shouldn't we use jobs as a measure of a politician's effectiveness?
Several reasons. First of all, it's a very difficult figure to measure. These are still estimates. You obviously can't check with all 330 million Americans to see who's working and who's not working. And for several reasons, in terms of just statistical analysis, many times when they're talking about new initial unemployment claims, which is a number that comes out every single week, for I think 55 out of the last 57 weeks, they've gone back and revised the previous week's number. So, and it's always been in the same direction. So many people celebrate these numbers or moan these numbers, but many times they're merely estimates. Even the jobs that are being lost versus jobs that are being created, there's probably some fair question about if these jobs are, you know, if someone loses a job in a factory making $50,000 a year with good benefits, and then a new job comes in that's a fast food restaurant. Well, that means that it was a wash in terms of number of unemployment, but obviously those are jobs that have two different values in the economy. It's way beyond control. Most politicians, even if they could create jobs, they would, but they can't. So they can't control jobs, and it's up to the consumer. The consumer's stuck in a cycle of uncertainty right now, which is being proven to be very difficult to break.
Why do you think that is?
There just isn't demand out there. People are trying to save as much money as they possibly can generally. And with no demand, employers and manufacturers are waiting to hire. And if there are no new jobs for people or people are concerned about their own job security, there is no demand. And most employers anyway will hire a human being as a last resort, not the first thing they choose to do in light of new demand.
What's the first thing they'll do?
Well, they look for less expensive and more flexible ways to get things done. They might outsource things. They might hire contractors for a while. They might try to use technology. You know, there's a reason that John Henry, the steel-driving man, still holds true today. Many employers will choose to use technology and machinery and computers or whatever rather than human beings because it's more efficient. And what I think is something that's really hidden and difficult to measure, but I think is definitely happening right now, rather than hire new people, most employers are choosing to pile more work onto their current staff because most people just have to take it.
Kevin McKinley is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for everyone. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Gary asks, my question is about required minimum distribution from regular tax-deferred IRAs. After age 70, does the IRS allow a person to transfer an amount of money from their regular IRA to their Roth IRA? I would like to pay tax from other sources. For instance, if my RMD would be $1,000 at the end of the year, can I transfer $1,000 from the regular IRA to my Roth IRA before the institution sends me the RMD at the end of the year? Thank you. And what in the heck did he just say, Kevin?
I was going to ask the same thing. I wasn't listening. Could you just go back to the beginning?
Wait, what's an RMD? That's the one. I get IRA, but I don't know RMD.
Okay, good. Something is starting to sink in after 3 years of doing this. So the IRA, of course, is your individual retirement account. And the RMD is the required minimum distribution that generally people who have reached the age of 70 and a half have to begin taking money out of the IRA and paying taxes on it. So what Gary's looking to do is basically two different things with one withdrawal from his IRA. Meeting his RMD requirement and then moving that money from the IRA to a Roth IRA. Both events are taxable, and that technically that is taxable income when he pulls it out, but one of them cannot qualify to be moved to a Roth IRA.
All right, so let's start with the RMD.
That's what you can't convert to an IRA. You have to take it, you have to pay taxes on it. You can convert an amount over the RMD, over the required minimum distribution, and move that to a Roth IRA, and again, still paying taxes on it when you do.
So how does that work, and what benefit would be gained?
Let's say Gary was told that he has to take at least $1,000 out of his IRA for an RMD, and he decides, I'm actually going to take $5,000 out of this. The $1,000 qualifies for the RMD, but then $4,000 can be moved to the Roth IRA, and by lowering the value of his current IRA, he will lower the RMDs that he has to take in the future, and he can always take money out of the Roth IRA tax-free in the future, but in the meantime, any future earnings are sheltered from tax. There's no required minimum distribution from Roth IRAs. So he's basically done having to take money out of that while he's alive and paying taxes on any of the earnings as well.
Would there be any reason for a person to want to take more money than they have to from an IRA?
Yes, if he were in a lower tax bracket in a specific year than he otherwise might be in the future, let's say it's after retirement and he doesn't have a job anymore, but it's before he's taking Social Security or a pension check, that might be a good time to move a greater amount of money out of the IRA into the Roth IRA. Or if he's got some losses that he's realized from investments or from a business venture or something, that's another good time to roll extra money out of the IRA into the Roth IRA.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Actually, send that email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, Kevin will have some advice on getting the most out of Social Security and also some tips on financial spring cleaning. But now to your calls for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Pat in Madison is with us first. Hi, Pat.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a somewhat recent retiree. I was a state employee for 30-some years. I have a 403B that's been doing really well in the last 6 months. Kind of been putting off a couple of house projects in anticipation of getting my hands on that money, but then I was discouraged by doing that, actually by a lending institution, which, of course, sends up a little bit of a red flag. But then I did refinance my home, and I got a good rate on that, and I also then had another appraisal done. So they suggested a HELOC and that I would not have to have another appraisal because I already had the one done, and the home equity line of credit is 4%. So I'm trying to decide which way to go. I mean, if I should start taking my annuity or withdrawals from the 403B, or should I do this line of credit?
To do the remodeling that you want to do, Pat.
Yeah.
Well, I would say, Pat, in your case, first of all, HELOC is a character from, I think, the second Harry Potter book.
I'm not sure what
it is. HELOC is a home equity line of credit and allows you, once it's established, it allows you to draw on any equity that the bank feels that you have in your home without applying. And when you pay it back, you basically only pay interest on it for the time being. And then generally somewhere down the road, there's some line in the contract that says that it will be converted to a fixed rate loan or refinanced or something like that. So it's a very inexpensive way to get access to the equity in your home without a huge process or expense to do it. I would much rather, Pat, have you, I want you to do what you're talking about to the home, but I want you to do it by using that home equity line of credit, because then you've got the money, and you've got the money to make the payments on the home equity line of credit in your 403B. If you were to take it all out of the 403B, it would all be taxed. And depending on your situation, the taxes that you pay on the 403B could be much higher than the interest that you pay on the home equity line of credit, even over a longer period of time. And then manage your income distributions from the 403B so that you're not taxed at a huge amount, but you can still use the payments from it to make the payments on the home equity line of credit. And just do it slowly and make sure that, you know, you get it done, but you keep the payments current so you obviously don't get the bank upset. But no, I don't think the lender is actually, you know, they might be trying to generate some business, but lenders don't make a huge amount of money on home equity lines of credit, so I think they're actually making a good suggestion to you based on liquidity and the net cost of the taxes versus the interest.
Thank you.
All right. Good luck with the remodel project, Pat. So if more listeners were doing what Pat is doing, that would increase demand, right, Kevin?
We're doing our part here, Joy. We're only one show, one man and one woman, and several people supporting us. But we will do our part to get America up and running again.
There we go. Marie in Stevens Point. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
Yes, what's your question?
My question is, as you all probably know, M&I Bank has been bought out by BMO Harris. And we received a letter about my husband's SEP IRA and telling us that they are no longer going to be able to act as the custodian for our self-directed IRA. And we're wondering what would be the tax ramifications of switching our SEP IRA into a regular IRA.
Hmm. So many acronyms on this show.
Yeah.
It's RMDs, IRAs, SEP IRAs, HELOCs, M&I.
Oh, I take it that that SEP means that is the self-directed part of that?
That's correct.
Fairly close. Self-employed mm-hmm. pension. But
okay.
Yes, you're right. It's just like a big IRA, big in the terms of the number of dollar amount that you can contribute to it. But if they can't be the custodian of the SEP and you still want to keep it there, they probably have individual IRAs that you can use and open that up and just make the transfer, or Roth IRAs for that matter, if you were to do it. But you are going to pay full taxes on the conversion to a Roth. And Mary, you said you are married?
Yes.
Okay, married filing jointly, correct?
Correct.
Okay. In your case, what I would look to do is, it's not a bad idea to convert some of that to a Roth IRA to the extent that you can remain under the top of the 15% federal income tax bracket. And for 2012, that's $70,700, and that's found on line 43 of the 1040. And because it's on line 43, typically that means that you could probably make about $90,000 or so as a married couple filing jointly and still fit under the top of that 15% tax bracket. So offhand, I would say, yeah, it's not a bad idea to do that as long as you're converting it at that 15% federal rate, not going over that amount, because then you're up into a 25% federal tax bracket and you're just better off waiting and delaying to do that. And the decision to convert it is probably independent of whether you're going to keep it at that same the same institution, because you can open up SEP IRAs at other places, or you can make the conversion where it's at and move it to an IRA or a Roth at your current provider.
Okay, I know we would get we would have tax ramifications if we change it to a Roth IRA, but would there be tax ramifications if we went from the SEP IRA to the traditional IRA?
That's a good question, and the answer to that is no.
Okay.
Oh, that was an easy one. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks very much, Marie, for the call. On Facebook, Sandy writes, I am looking for some advice on building credit for a college student. My son is looking to buy a new car with mom and dad as co-signers. Although the loan is co-signed, will this help build his credit score?
Sure, as long as the payments are made on time. That's not a bad idea at all, and it's a good way to get started, because it's probably something that is needed for transportation. And it, I'm actually a proponent of doing this. A lot of people think that, you know, giving some type of credit to a college student is like, you know, handing them a running chainsaw. It can be very dangerous to give them credit if it's not monitored by the parents. So you can have some huge mistakes down the road that can be life-altering for the college student. But if the parents are willing to not only monitor the payments to make sure that they're made on time, but actually be willing to step in and make the payments if the college student can't do it, yes, it will help the college student's credit. Not a great deal, but it's a good thing to have something on there to get started, so that when he or she goes to actually get a loan on his or her own, then there is some history there and a score on which the future lender can make the decision.
Got it. George in Fond du Lac is with us now. Hi, George.
Hi. After the crash we had in 08, I moved most of my money when it came back out, or out of the stable fund. I put most of it in a total PIMCO bond fund, a total return. And I'm thinking at this time might be a good time to move into stocks and bonds. And the other question I have is there something safer out there to put retirement money in that can give us a 4 to 6% return with very little or no risk? Those are my two questions.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And the answer to that last one is no.
Mm-hmm.
There are no things out there, George, that offer 4 to 6% rates of return with little or no risk. There are very few things out there that offer 2% return with little or no risk. And you can move it out of bonds in search for higher rates of return, as long as you're comfortable watching that account go down 30 to 40% again. Because it can and it will happen. It's not a question of if it will happen, it's when and at what point it will drop to, and what you will need the money for at that time. So if you can't stand that, I wouldn't stick your neck out further. You know, it's one of the biggest mistakes that most people make, especially in retirement, is not looking at their situation and realizing that they actually can get by with a very, very low rate of return for the foreseeable future. What they can't handle is that 30 to 40% drop that can just destroy the portfolio, and especially while you're taking income out of it and while you're not earning any other money outside of it to offset that drop in value. If you'll indulge me, George, which you obviously do because you listen to the show, there's an exercise I do with my clients that shows that if you could have two different portfolios, and one portfolio, Portfolio A, makes 3% a year in, year out for 5 years, And Portfolio B makes 10% the first year, 10% the second year, loses 20% the third year, but then in the fourth year makes 10%, and the fifth year makes 10%. You still average an annualized rate of return on that second volatile portfolio, George, of 3.2% versus the other one, you just get the straight 3%. Most people in your situation would take Portfolio B thinking they were going to make a lot more money, but they usually don't because the drop is so bad, and the drop is even worse when you're actually in retirement. So if you're looking for other investments out there, I'm a huge proponent of certificates of deposit and Series I savings bonds. The rates on the latter have dropped recently, but those things actually are safe and, more important, liquid, and even more importantly, transparent. So you know exactly what you're in, you know exactly what you're getting on it. And sometimes, getting a little bit rate of return and not losing a bunch is more important than getting a greater rate of return and then potentially losing a bunch.
Thanks a lot.
All right, George, thank you and good luck. Linda in Egg Harbor is with us now. Hello, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
My question is, I retired at age 62, but I have continued to work. Now, I understand Social Security is computed on an average of your best years over your lifetime. If what I'm earning after age 62, one of the years would be greater than one of the previous years, would they recalculate Social Security?
Well, first of all, Linda, back up for a second. I don't think you grasp the concept of retirement.
Yeah, that's right.
I have not, no.
When you retire, you stop working. If you're not stopped working, you're not retired. It actually does. It's your 35 highest years of earnings, and there's an inflation-adjusted calculation in there as well that goes on top of that. But usually in this era, is it full-time work or part-time work?
It's full-time work.
It's full-time work. Then I bet it probably, there's probably some, you worked at the movie theater or at the cafe or something in high school or college or something and made about $1,100 back in 1978. And now you actually are boosting that. You're wiping that year out in your earnings and adding in a full-time 2012's earnings in on top of that. So, yeah, it's not going to be a huge deal, but it is going to help.
Well, thank you very much for answering my question.
All right. Thank you, Linda. You know, this leads us right into our smart assets segment and the series that we've been doing. A recent report from the federal government warned of concern over the financial stability of Social Security and Medicare. And over the coming weeks, we are addressing what you can do to get the most benefit from these programs. And Kevin, we did touch on Social Security's retirement component last week.
Yeah, we did. And today we're going to talk about a much less discussed but much bigger problem. That's the disability component of Social Security. This is money that you would get if you were working and for some reason, mental, physical distress cannot work and earn any money anymore. It's very rarely talked about. It's very rarely thought about. Most people don't have any concept of what it means to go on or try to get disability benefits until it's too late. It's in much worse financial shape, the program is, than Medicare and Social Security's retirement. The Congressional Budget Office says that the disability plan will run out of money in 2016. That's 4 years from now. There's been a huge spike in recent claims. Some people have said that the reason that unemployment has gone down and the reason that there's been a spike in disability claims is because a lot of people have said, well, I don't have enough money to retire. I'm not old enough to collect Social Security in the retirement form, so I'm actually going to get on the disability portion of the program so that I can live. There's about 2 million more people on that program now than there were 18 months ago. It's a huge problem and a huge issue, and it's definitely something that's going to affect more people sooner than the Medicare or the Social Security issues. So you definitely don't want to rely on the Social Security program to cover yourself in the future if you do get injured and can't work.
Yeah, and to claim disability Social Security, you do have to have some sort of physical or mental disability.
That's right. You do have to actually, you can't just say, I'm out of money.
Right.
That's not the disability according to their prerequisites.
So what's wrong with counting on the Social Security disability program as a personal safety net?
It's very difficult to get, and even if you are fortunate enough to be awarded the disability benefit, it's not very much money. Those payments that are going out to all these people, they generally run about $1,100 per month, which for most of our listeners, that's going to cover a basic mortgage payment or a rent payment, much less all the other expenses that they have. It's a very long process. It can take years to actually get approved. And for some reason, that's good. You know, they want to try to get as much fraud out of the program and make sure you actually are disabled. But if you are really disabled and you can't earn money, you could go without a paycheck for months or years. There are lots of restrictions and qualifications over, as you mentioned, who can get it, and then what kind of earnings you can have after you're awarded disability as well. And again, the problem, even for people who are healthy and have enough money, is the future solvency of the program. It's highly unlikely to be there in its current form within a few years.
So what might we look at instead, especially if we're concerned about a disability?
This is an insurance that should be added to the lexicon, much in the same way that homeowners and auto insurance and life insurance and health insurance and even long-term care insurance is considered. Even if you're younger, especially if you have someone relying on your paycheck or if you are relying on your paycheck, you definitely want to look at private disability insurance, either purchased on your own or through your employer as a group plan, or if you have a plan at work, you can also purchase supplemental disability insurance on top of that as well.
How much does a disability policy typically cost?
It depends on your age and your occupation and the income from that occupation, the type of job that is covered, whether it's any occupation or just your own, if you're disabled so that you can't do your own occupation or any occupation whatsoever. Generally, it runs about, the premiums for the policy run about 2% of your income, and that usually gives you about a 60 to 70% payout of your current earnings as well in the form of disability payments. So let's say you're a person making, your teacher making $50,000 a year, the policy might cost maybe $80 a month, and if you were to become disabled to the point that you could not teach anymore, it might pay out $30,000 to $40,000 per year if you're able to make a successful claim on your disability. Now, keep in mind, the occupation component of this is very important. Many disabilities will not qualify for a lifetime of payments. Some qualify for a lifetime Social Security retirement benefits. Others only qualify for a certain amount of years. So your occupation that's covered can have a huge effect both on your coverage and the cost.
So where do I sign up?
You definitely want to go with some of the largest providers, Guardian, Unum, I think Hartford is another very large one. But more importantly, you want an agent representing you who does this on a regular basis and who can hopefully shop for many different policies for you with several different companies to compare them. You don't want to do this just on price alone. One thing you might want to consider is there is an inflation rider in this, which is adds a lot of expense to it, meaning that the payment jumps, the payment to you, if you make a successful claim, rises, say, 3 to 5% a year, but the premiums can be 30% higher than if you purchase one that gives you the option to make a future purchase of more coverage without any health screening whatsoever. So don't shop on cost alone, and definitely, like other kinds of insurance, review it every year to make sure that you're signing up for what you actually need.
We will have some spring cleaning tips in just a few minutes on this edition of On Your Money. But if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And our next caller is another Kevin in Whitewater. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Nice name, Kevin.
Oh, thank you so much. So let's see here. Where do I begin? Well, I actually just turned 22 today, so it's
happy birthday.
Oh, thank you so much. It took me 22 years to muster up the courage to call in.
that's not uncommon, Kevin.
My question, I guess, is I'm graduating with a 4-year degree in December, actually, with a degree in international sales and finance, sales and marketing, excuse me, sorry, I'm nervous. I've had my fair share of business courses, but I guess in terms of finance, I think I'm sorely lacking, and I have really no idea where to go in terms of once I get my first full-time job and a consistent stream of paychecks, I want to, you know, invest my money somewhere, maybe play with the stock market, you know, essentially multiply my money. Wondering if your speaker, Mr. McKinley, can provide some insight and some avenues where I could, you know, test that kind of stuff out.
All right. That's a good one. So new college grad, what does he do with his money, Kevin?
There is one step and one step only that someone in your position needs to do, Kevin. You can play around in the stock market if you want, but don't look upon that as a proxy for investing and saving. Look upon that much in the same way you would about going to the casino. What I would love you to do is let me ask you this, Kevin. How much money, if you don't mind me asking, how much money do you earn right now?
I have a part-time job, making $12.50 an hour. I can turn that into full-time and make about $35,000, $36,000, $37,000 once I graduate in December. So,
okay, great. This is an excellent point. Does your employer have a retirement plan at work?
Yeah, I would reckon so. Yeah.
Okay. Here you go. You're making maybe $12,000 a year right now, and you're surviving. And in theory, you'll graduate in December, and then you'll start making a job either at your current employer or at some other one. You might make $35,000 a year. All you have to do, Kevin, there's only one thing you have to do to become financially independent, and that is max out your at-work retirement plan savings account.
Yeah.
That would be like a 401k or a 403b, and you can put in the lesser of your earnings or $17,000. And if you said, I want to be rich someday, what's the best way to do that for the average person?
Now you're speaking my language.
All right. This is a get-rich-slow plan, keep in mind. And what I'd like you to do, you waited 22 years to make this call, so this is a very important thing for you to do. Make 10 years of max-out contributions to your at-work retirement plan, okay? Now, even if you say, hey, that's $17,000, that's all the money in the world to me. Well, you're getting by now on $12,000 a year. If you'd make $35,000, and you put $17,000 of that into this plan, not only will you pay much less in taxes, but you will learn to live on less, which is the key actually to becoming financially independent. It's not making more money, it's learning to live on less because you can control that. If you said, okay, then what do I do? How long do I have to make these contributions? I'd say just make it for 10 years. Make it from the age of 23 to 33 and then stop and do whatever you want to do with your money. Stop contributing to your 401k. Don't do anymore. Just let what you've put in there ride and you'll be fine. It's much better to make these big contributions early when you're broke. No one else is relying on your income and then generally transition into having more income and more spending than the other way around, which is the way most people do that. They say, I'm 22. I don't have to worry about things in the future. This is for old people. I'll spend my money now, and then eventually I'll start saving for retirement. You will be much happier and much more successful, Kevin, if you save a lot now and then stop saving rather than saving nothing now and starting to save down the road.
Okay, and is it appropriate, you know, right after college to get with somebody in your profession, speak with a consultant or financial advisor to plan? I mean,
you can sure try. It's hard to find somebody who's good anyway. It's harder to find someone when you don't have a lot of assets for them to invest, but you can look for an hourly financial plan. Sometimes with that company you work with, they might have a representative of the retirement plan who will sit down and talk with you. You can also go to a place like Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard, and they can do kind of a cursory review of your finances and give you some projections and recommendations as well. And usually that's a fairly inexpensive process. You kind of get what you pay for, but it's not a bad deal for someone in your situation.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call.
So, Kevin, what are you going to do for your birthday today?
I'm working. Yeah, I'm actually on my commute to work at the moment. But when I get back to school, it's straight to the library for an evening of study.
What a blast. That sounds great.
Actually, Kevin, you've done us a lot of good because most of us listening to this show are older than you, and we are really regretting how old we are. And so you've actually given us some insight into the day of a typical 22-year-old, your birthday no less. And so we don't feel as bad about being as old as we actually are.
Well, I hope that you can have a wonderful time this weekend or something, Kevin. Thanks a lot for calling. That is wonderful. And that was great advice, Kevin. Where were you when I was 22? I wish I would have done that, but here we are.
Would you really have accepted financial advice from an 8-year-old? I don't think so.
Probably not. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and I am accepting his financial advice today, and you can too. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. There are 6 weeks of spring left, so during that time on Your Money, we are going to devote this portion of the show to spring cleaning tips. Thank you very much, Kevin. What kind of spring cleaning are we going to do?
Well, some of it will be traditional and some not. So we will talk in a few weeks about cleaning up your financial situation. And today we're going to address getting rid of stuff that you don't need by cleaning out your house. The best way to get started, and this is a much bigger hurdle and therefore more important, getting finished.
Oh, you mean you're just going to tell me how to clean out my house? You're not actually going to do it?
Oh, I'll stop by, but the amount of beer that you might have to pay for, you might look at that and say, I think we'll do it ourselves next year.
So how do we get started doing this?
Look at each room through the eyes of others. If you can't get an objective view of your own clutter and junk situation, ask someone to come over, a trusted friend or relative, and say, what would you get rid out of or what really stands out here? If you're fortunate enough to be in a committed relationship with someone, that person has been dying to tell you exactly what you should be getting rid of, so they'll be happy to tell you what should be thrown out. If you really want to do a good job with this, so have guests over. The minute you announce that you are having some kind of party, especially if it's people who, you know, you're not really familiar with, you'll start seeing every single crack, every single thing, speck of dust in your entire house, and it'll make you frantic. So if you make a date, it'll get you cleaning and going in a much quicker fashion than if you just say, I'll do it on the next nice day.
That's why we haven't had a dinner party lately.
It really is. And we actually have a three-phase plan once you do get to that point.
All right. So what is the three-phase plan?
Phase one is sell, phase two is giveaway, and phase three is throwaway. First, if you have some things that have value, you may want to hold a thrift sale. Again, schedule the date for the sale right now and hold yourself to it, because if you're going to have people showing up to pick through the things in your garage or your driveway, you're going to be much more committed and motivated to get things out there. Talk with your neighbors, get them on board if they want to put some stuff in together. It's a nicer sale, and again, you'll be holding yourself accountable to those people. If you do have items that are smaller and have higher value, you may want to look at getting the most bang for your buck by selling them on eBay, though, rather than selling them in the yard sale. You get a broader range of buyers, especially if you have some antique or vintage items of questionable value. You might want to put those up on eBay first and see what you can get for them.
Yeah, and I imagine we then give away what we can't sell.
Yes, you do. Goodwill, Salvation Army, even FreeCycle. You want to contact the people first and say, do you have specific drives that you'll come by and pick up, or will you have someone actually come to the house and pick through a pile and see what they will take and won't take, so that I don't have to haul it all out there and then haul it back? You definitely do want to save the receipt for the tax deduction to show that you did donate this stuff, because it is potentially deductible.
What if Goodwill doesn't want some of my stuff?
Then that's when you have to bite the bullet and throw this stuff away or recycle it if nobody else wants it. The best way to do this, again, in the notion of holding yourself accountable, is to rent a dumpster and schedule that thing to be dropped off on a certain day and picked up on another day. It's usually a couple hundred bucks or so to get a dumpster, and they'll leave it there for 10 to 14 days, and you get to fill the thing up. And it can be kind of satisfying to get all these big items out of there and really make some big space in your place. But knowing that the dumpster is not only coming, but leaving, again, motivates you and puts a deadline on yourself. You might want to check again with the hauler too, to say what items won't you take and or won't you be able to recycle.
You know, that reminds me, Kevin, it does, and it really does feel good once you've cleaned up your space. This happened here at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. We did some office moves, and we still have dumpsters all over the hallways. But I moved recently from one office to another and just cleaned out all the junk. And there was some recycling and tossing, and I feel refreshed and renewed and ready to go get going.
It's amazing that it's actually a reason people should move. I mean, you should just sell your house and get out just to get rid of the junk that is just piling up and that you have absolutely no need for whatsoever. And you can go out and then buy new junk to replace it.
And then now, instead of a kind of a crummy, dirty white color for the walls, we have a new paint in our office, and it's swimming blue.
Swimming blue. Yeah.
Yes, it's very nice.
So Wisconsin Public Radio is underwater? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think it looks like a swimming pool, though. That's what it looks like. So anyway, you'll have to see it next time you're down here.
All right.
Kevin McKinley, a certified financial planner. He is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kate in Lake Mills is with us. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good. What's up?
My husband and I are kind of on the crest of the sandwich generation. We have a young family. My in-laws are, my father-in-law is retired. My mother-in-law still works part-time. They have just inherited her mother's house, a single floor plan, so they're going to move to that home. They cannot sell it because my husband's grandmother is still living, but they have it in a trust. And their plan is to sell their primary residence and take that chunk of change as kind of their retirement nest egg. But their primary residence needs quite a bit of work. My brother-in-law is happy to rent it from them and provide a steady stream of income for them. And we're trying to advocate for that because they haven't made the most financially responsible choices in the past, and we're concerned that if they have this chunk of change, it's just going to be spent on a new motorhome or on a condo in Florida, and those are not really things that they can afford. But we don't really know how to have this conversation with them.
How old are your in-laws, Kate?
My mother-in-law just turned, she turned 66 in May, and my father-in-law is 70.
Okay. Well, first of all, this is very common that there are members of a family who feel that both from a philosophical and a potential personal responsibility issue that other older people who are used, they're used to taking direction from these older people, now are entering a phase of their lives where maybe they could use some advice, both of concern over their well-being and a concern, quite frankly, Kate, that you and your husband may be financially responsible for them at some point, and it's hard enough for most families to take care of their own finances, especially it's more so with the you know, the older generation or the greater generation. So it's something that will definitely come up in the future. Has the subject ever been broached with them or not?
Sort of. We've kind of tried to bring it up, and they are pretty resistant to talking about it. But I think that that is our concern, is that right around the time our oldest son is going to be going to college, we have this feeling that the wheels are going to kind of come off.
Yep.
He just started kindergarten, so that's 12 years away. So we have two other kids behind him that we'd like to finance their education. And so the idea that right at that time, you know, it just, it seems like it's looming, and I don't really know. We've tried to kind of talk to them about what they feel like they would like us to do for them in terms of both their care and kind of, and it, that hasn't been really well received.
Yeah, it's very difficult, and it's hard because they know that they're getting older, and they have, you know, they've gone to funerals for the for their friends who they consider to be young people. Are their parents still around?
My mother-in-law's mother is still alive.
Okay.
Just moved to a nursing home. She's in her late 80s.
Okay. That's a bad sign for you, Kate, because it means that this is going to be a 40-year proposition for you. So it's good that you're addressing this issue right now. You know what I would do? I would talk with them about how they feel about her mother and her situation, and say, how are you dealing with that? And see if what they're feeling right now can be, you know, switched or added on to how they would want to be cared for at that time, and say, you know, what have you done with? Because they'll want to talk about it and say that, you know, she's cost us an arm and a leg, or she didn't have a will, or we don't know where any of her money is. And
well,
say, okay.
And she actually planned very well. I mean, she worked her whole life. She has a pension. She was worked in a school system. And it's kind of an interesting contrast because my in-laws haven't really prepared as well. So,
Yeah, the big difference is she was born in, you know, 1928 or whatever, 1922, and they were born in 1947. That's the interesting contrast right there, and it's being repeated in literally millions of households around the country and around the world, quite frankly. So I would talk with them about that. I would say this, Kate, you do have some familial obligation to try to take care of them at any given point, but there are other people involved in this. There are other resources for it as well. And so you can say to them, look, you know, we're going to try to do the same thing for you that you're doing for your mother in this case. But keep in mind that, you know, there's only so much we can do. So try to make sure that you're in as good a shape as you can. And if you talk to them and they still reject you, quite frankly, for the time being anyway, you've done everything you could. It's not worth arguing over because it's something that may never actually come to fruition. And even if you win out, you might still lose because there'd be years of acrimony between now and the time that it actually does come to fruition. So I think you're fair to talk about it. And especially, I'm guessing you're the one who's the driver of this and your husband's maybe not quite as comfortable talking about it with them.
Yeah, I think my husband is kind of, feels frustrated by the entire thing. And I think that he has sort of decided, you know what, if they're not going to be willing to talk to us now, it's really going to be hard for me to kind of subsidize their life when it comes to that, which I know isn't the truth. I know that we would do whatever we could to help them when they need it, but I think that he's reached his frustration level, and that just makes me, you know, I'm worried
frustrated.
And I'm worried about the relationship between them. Continues to be an issue.
You are right to try to address this stuff proactively. However, at a certain point, what you do is you say, okay, we've done what we can. We're not going to, what you just said, Kate, was very important. You're not going to damage the relationship. You're not going to bring it up. You will be surprised. It will probably take too long, but they will come around eventually if the need should arise. And it'll seem like finally they actually went to a lawyer and had these things drawn up. But you're much better off just saying, okay, we've done what we can do for the time being. Let's just let it germinate, not bring it up again. And then maybe in 3 to 5 years, or if there is some major crisis, we'll do it at that time. But otherwise, we've done everything we can. Let's forget about it and move on and not let it destroy this relationship, because it's something that may never happen. And so it doesn't seem worth it to hurt the relationship any more than you already might have.
Kate, thank you, and good luck to you. Linda in Viroqua. Hi, Linda.
Hello. And good
we're
morning.
Almost I'm sorry, Linda. We're almost out of time, so if you could be as brief as possible.
Quick question. I've inherited $50,000 in DNP Select Income Funds, and they've recently voted to change and amend the fund character and to amend the fund's fundamental investment restrictions. It seemed to be pretty stable, and then recently I noticed that it was climbing rather high and then dumped down for a period, and now it's climbing back.
What can Kevin do for you, Linda?
You want to know if you should hang on to it or not?
Yeah, should I hang on to it? It yields, like, I think 6.5.
Yeah, it's hard to give. It's not a bad fund. It's not something I would make as a huge portion of your portfolio. Add up all your assets, Linda, and don't let a fund like this represent more than, say, 10% of it. That's the best answer I can give you without knowing more about your financial situation. So if it makes up more than 10% of your total worth, I would sell it down to the point where you got where it was less than 10% and put it in something that has nothing else to do with it, like CDs or savings bonds.
I apologize, Linda, for not having more time for you, because we only have time now for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, it's itsdeductible.com. It's actually a longer string, but TurboTax provides a free service that allows you to list things that you donate that can be deductible, and it even gives you a chance to calculate the value so that next year you can save on taxes by all the junk that you've given away. It's deductible.com, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. We have time, though, for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He is with us just about every Tuesday at this time for On Your Money. Coming up tonight at 8 o'clock, it's election night coverage. It's coverage, results, and analysis of the recall primary election today. That's starting tonight at 8 here on the Ideas Network. And we will follow up on those results tomorrow on this show. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.